to deserve your support. Thank you very much. The next item is anyone who lives in the neighborhood knows that we have that there's been renovations going on at Golden Gate Heights Park. And we have Alexis Ward from the Department of Recreation Department, who's the project manager on the renovation. So Alexis, do you want to take it?
Sure. Hi, everyone. Good evening. Again, my name is Alexis Ward, project manager with San Francisco Rec and Park. And I have a few slides I'd like to share this evening to show a little bit about the background of the project and where we're at with construction. So I'm just going to share my screen. Can you all see that okay?
Yes.
Yes. Okay, great. All right, so the project is the playground renovation, which is a Let's Play SF initiative project. This is a program to renovate 13 of our most deserving playgrounds around the city. And the work at Golden Gate Heights is actually coupled together the Let's Play project with a Community Opportunity Fund project, which is a program from our park bond to renovate other areas of the park. So these are just a few photos, a reminder what the park used to look like before. I know we have a lot of longtime residents, so I'm sure you guys are very familiar with the condition that it used to be in. So you can see the fields and then the playground with that one kind of lone structure in the two slides. So when we did our community outreach, we talked a little bit about our opportunities and constraints, especially with the playground renovation. We knew that the playground footprint would remain the same. We would need to adhere to current codes and playground safety standards. There's a need for durable and resilient materials. We would need to consider the budget. We wanted the playground, the design to reflect the beautiful setting. And then we also wanted to coordinate this work with the Community Opportunity Fund project, which is the COF project that I mentioned. This is the conceptual design that we came up with community input and help of our landscape architecture team, showing the different playground elements and how they would be situated around the playground. The primary feature being this tall play tower, other elements being these wooden arches, these disc sort of steps on springs, a saucer sort of basket swing, slides, a climbing wall, and then we had a bobble sort of seat kind of seesaw structure. We actually ended up having to switch that out for a spinner due to some concerns from our maintenance yard. Here were some of the renderings that our landscape architect put together, just showing the overall kind of aerial view of the playground, and then also the new picnic area. We would be expanding, I believe there previously used to be maybe one or two tables, and we're replacing those. There'll be three tables, and they will be situated adjacent to the new playground. And we're also renovating the entrance. We moved this south of the planter area to make sure that it could be ADA accessible and provide a vehicular access when needed to our maintenance team. And then this is the bioretention area to help capture some of the drainage from the field so that it wouldn't continue to flow down the paths and into the lower areas of the park. Here are some of those renderings that we did early on. This is the playground with the bioretention area, the tall tower. Here are those wooden arches and the swing. The picnic area you can see in this bottom right one. And then, or the bottom left, excuse me, bottom right, you can see again the field across the bioretention area with the playground beyond. Just going over our budget and schedule. So we had a number of funding sources on this project. The overall budget was just around $2.8 million. As I said, it was a combination of a Let's Play project, which had both Parks Alliance funding as well as funding from our 2012 bond. And then we had funding from the COF program. The community had worked really hard to apply to that program and also to advocate with Supervisor Yee for funding. The community also directly donated funds to the project. This is our schedule here on the right. We started construction last September. We are planning on wrapping up in June and hopefully opening to the public in July. And then we have what's called a closeout period where we work on our closeout documents with the contractor that follows the work being done in the field. So the construction status. So I'm sure a lot of you have walked in the park and maybe even know it better than me at this point if you're out there every day. I'm usually out there once a week, but obviously we're well into the project. So all the demolition's complete. The sod just got installed this week. We had our irrigation system installed. All the playground equipment is in. I believe all the new fencing is in also and getting painted. We have a new backflow preventer for the irrigation system and a new water meter. We also have the new concrete is done. The asphalt paves, I believe, just wrapped up this earlier this week. And we have all our picnic tables and benches on site. And then those are going to be going in over the next few weeks. So some of our outstanding work, I believe the fence is still being painted. It's going to first be painted black, and then one face of the slats is going to be painted a color. So they're working on that. They're doing the planting, getting some of the trees in the bioretention area planted. Then we'll be working on the nature exploration area next week, actually, and installing the site furnishings, and then completing the curb ramp at that entrance. Here are a few photos from the construction. This is our nature exploration area. We had some logs that we were stockpiling and storing that were going to be used for that area. This is the new asphalt path as it wraps around the north side of the field and heads to the playground. You can see the irrigation system is on and running, the sod that just went in. At the bottom here, you can see that the play equipment was in and the fencing, and then just another view of that large tower. And that's it. I'm happy to leave the presentation up or take questions. I believe I did get one question in advance of folks wanting to know if the picnic tables would be permitted. And the answer is yes, they will be permitted and available on our website to permit. And we will have new signs at the park too that will have the information for how folks can go about that. So if, I'm not sure how questions are being handled or if there's who's moderating the discussion, or I am happy to open up the chat and see if there's anything that came in there.
Yeah, sure. People can put their questions in the chat if there are any.
Yeah, I don't see any. The idea is that you're thinking that it will reopen in July. Is that what you're thinking?
Yes, that's what we're thinking right now. We'll be coordinating with our public affairs team to set that date. You know, it hasn't been established yet, you know, working with the supervisor's office and all of our, of course, our community stakeholders. We know that this project wouldn't be possible without you all. So we'll be coordinating with you too.
Okay.
There is one question in the chat. Are the potholes in the past and other parts of the park going to be repaired or filled in? Question.
Yes. So right now our scope is limited to the field area and everywhere that is fenced off. So we're not going to be addressing other areas of the park. I have been in touch with Frank about those potholes. And I think that he's hoping to dig up some funding for it. I was helping do some cost estimating. And, you know, I had encouraged also just to put in 311 calls to the city for our maintenance team. So there's a question, will there be a grand opening event? I imagine that there will be. I believe we have started some smaller events. I know that we opened George Christopher Playground maybe last week. So I think there will likely be something similar, but we'll still probably want to be mindful of, you know, attendance numbers. I'm not sure what the restrictions will be like, but we'll want to make sure that we're, yeah, following any health orders that would be in place at the time that we have the event.
Great, thank you.
Yeah, I really wanted to thank Alexis for all the work. She's done a lot of work, has been involved, a lot of phone calls and emails back and forth, and we very much appreciate all the the work that's gone on. It's going to be really nice when it's done. Although I must say, a little disconcerting to watch them unroll grass. You know? They lay this out. It just doesn't look like that should be right.
Yeah, it's a little strange to watch. Yeah, but it is really great when you see it go down. It's a lot of gratification there when that happens. So
yeah, it looks very nice. It looks gorgeous right now. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Yeah, this community has been really wonderful to work with. So yeah, thank you to everyone for just being so communicative and supportive. It's been a great partnership.
Someone asked if it's gopher proofed.
No, there's no like mesh or anything. That actually is really hard for our maintenance to maintain in this kind of condition. You know, if we have like raised beds for vegetables, that kind of stuff, that's when we put in like a gopher wire, but not in a field like this. But I haven't heard our park service area managers mention that as a big problem. I couldn't be sure though. So
they're there, but I would say it's not a huge problem like it is at some other parks.
Okay.
And maybe the coyotes are eating them, who knows. Well, thank you very much. It's great to get that update, and again, thank you very much for all your work, and we'll look forward to the reopening.
Yeah, sounds great. And I'll just put my email address in the chat. If there's any other questions that come up, folks can reach out to me that way.
Great, thank you. And then now we have a very brief presentation from Carla Kozak, who's about the Block Champion Program for Resilient District 7.
Thank you. Let's see, there should be speaker view, I thought, but anyway, I'm not getting myself in speaker view, but everybody else is. So good evening, everyone. This is a brief update on the status of the Golden Gate Heights participatory budget project for Block Champions, which secured funding from Supervisor Yee's office back in 2019. Now, that was the original name. It is now branded the Strong Block Program. Regardless of the name, its mission remains the same: to increase the level of connectivity and safety at the block level across Golden Gate Heights. And the program, which has found success in other neighborhoods, accomplishes this by supporting an individual resident or a team of residents with guidance, resources, and programming, such as hosting block parties, as they connect with their neighbors and learn how to support each other during times of stress. And certainly we are just emerging from a time of great stress, but I think we all know that's COVID was huge, but we have, you know, there's so many other stresses that that will befall us. We're still in a drought. That means the long fire season. That means air quality. There could be heat issues. And of course, we are in fault country. So there's always earthquakes to consider. So this is one level of getting to know your neighbors, looking out for each other, keeping ourselves and each other safe during any sort of emergencies. So during the pandemic, a group comprised of several neighborhood leaders has been meeting on Zoom for several months, and we're working on the development of this program, and we hope to have it ready for rollout by the end of summer. So stay tuned and get ready to meet or reconnect with your neighbors. And I hope to meet many of you in person before too long. So thank you very much. You'll be hearing more about this.
Can you give just a very briefly what the idea of that there will be people on sort of ideally each block or every couple of blocks that could coordinate things? Just real briefly.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. Thanks, Sally. So yeah, the goal would be to have a person, what was called a block champion, and for lack of another term, I will refer to them as a block champion, on at least every few blocks. To have one on every block within Golden Gate Heights would be ideal. And they would be trained. They would have a very, you know, a guide, a playbook that is being edited and worked on now. It has lots of information and very well organized. And they would be trained how to connect with neighbors, check on neighbors. They would have some equipment to help in terms of emergencies. And, you know, other things that we would add to this as, you know, as the years go on. But the most important thing is getting to know your neighbors so that you feel good and safe and about checking on somebody or reaching out to somebody or knowing that there's someone on your street who is particularly vulnerable for whatever reason, for age or infirmities or, you know, in a wheelchair, any number of things. So that's why the most important start to this is to have block parties, not on every block, but, you know, in say, a square of blocks, getting together so that the people in that area can put a name to a face, know who lives next door to you, know who lives across the street, know who lives down the street. And there's data that this is shown to be one of the most successful ways of keeping neighborhoods safe is if people get to know each other under pleasant and fun circumstances and then keep in touch after that. So I hope that helps. And I'm also hoping that people are interested in this, that you'll come out, meet your neighbors at a block party and maybe think about, you know, hey, I work from home. I'm here a lot. I like my neighbors. I like my street. I would like to volunteer in the capacity of the block champion to have the strongest block possible.
And if you're interested in doing this and being a part of it, you can contact either Golden Gate Heights or Sharp. Both of us have people who are involved in this project. So we will, it's still kind of I get the impression it's still in the working everything out stage. It's not operational quite yet, but it should be probably within the next, certainly year, if not just a few months.
Yeah, I would say probably sooner than that. Certainly within the next 6 months, maybe by the end of the summer.
Great. Just get in touch with us, either neighborhood association, if you want more details. So thank you very much, Carla.
Sure, thank you.
And Carla, and I don't know, is it Dennis from Sharp or someone? Anyway, you guys have been like having Zoom meetings up the wazoo about this issue. So thank both of you for going to those, attending those, and representing us, our neighborhoods, representing very well.
You're welcome.
So the majority of the rest of the evening basically is going to be turned over to a discussion about crime in the neighborhood. It certainly seems as if crime has gone up in recent years. Certainly in the past year. It's also true that it's a lot more easy to find out information with Nextdoor and Facebook and everything like that. When something happens, everybody hears about it, whereas maybe 10 years ago, that was not necessarily the case. So we wanted to have some people come that could give a little bit of present talk about it, the issue from their various perspectives. And so we have Felicious Wyatt, who's the Security Services Manager for San Francisco SAFE, which is the Safety Awareness for Everyone. And he can talk about some crime prevention tips and things. We have Lieutenant Clayton Harmston from the Terrell District, who can talk a little bit about statistics on crimes and sort of what the situation really is in our neighborhood as opposed to necessarily citywide. We have Supervisor Myrna Melgar will be coming, and she will be you'll be able to ask her questions and she'll be talking about things. And then we have Nancy Tung from Stop Crime San Francisco, who will also be speaking. And then we'll have a question and answers period. We have some prepared questions that we got from both neighborhood associations, as well as people when they registered for this event. A number of people submitted questions, so that's where we got our sort of prepared questions from. And then if you have any additional questions that you think about, you can always put them in the chat, and we'll try to monitor those and keep up with those, and hopefully some of those will get asked. Now, we won't get to every question, and we'll do as many as we can. We're going to see, hopefully we'll be able to, if there's any questions that aren't, that are asked but not gotten to, our speakers have offered to look at those and possibly answer them, and then the responses will be put on the websites or Facebook pages and things like that. Just a final reminder to everybody that this is being recorded, and it will be put up on the Sharp Facebook page. There's also, if you want, at the bottom of your screen, there's a, I think it says live transcript, and you can click on that and actually see the words if that makes it easier for you to follow or understand what's being said. That's just an option. Those were all the reminders. So I think we'll start with Felicious Wyatt, who is the Security Services Manager for San Francisco SAFE. And if you want to give about a 10-minute little discussion about, you know, tips on crime prevention for all of us that we can all use.
All right. Well, thank you so much. And Ms. Carla with the Block Champions, that is very interesting, because that is basically the anchor program of SAFE, which is neighborhood organizing, business watch organizing, as well as a combination of the two that's called community organizing. I will be talking specifically about residential security target hardening. And I want to preface this engagement by saying I will not be trying to frighten individuals, but I will actually let you know basically what is. About half of residential burglaries are through unlocked doors and windows. It is not that people don't have locks and adequate locking devices. They don't lock them. So it's very, very important that they be locked. We will also, as I go through, we will talk about the garage break-ins and intrusions, which have been in the news recently. But now let me say this. When you look at residential security target hardening, there is no one solution to the problem. So when we look at residential target hardening, we're looking at the multiplier effect. You should have good locks and locking devices. You should have good lighting. You should have alarm systems. You should have CCTV. But just remember, it's the multiplier effect. No one solution solves everything. Now, I will begin by saying we would look at properties in layers. There's a perimeter layer, there's a building layer, and then there's also an interior layer that we address when our organization comes out and performs a residential security survey for a single family dwelling, if you will. Now, we also provide commercial. Now, a lot of people kind of get it confused. Well, I'm in a condominium, that's commercial. But as far as our organization is concerned, it is called a commercial security survey, just like a business would. But now let me just talk to you about several things. Now, the concept of crime prevention through environmental design is always applied when our organization comes out and performs a security survey. And at the perimeter, what we're concerned about most is addressing, because it really helps first responders, because as you know, seconds can mean the difference between life and death. So can your address number be seen from all directions on a street? And those numbers should be of a high contrasting color and be illuminated during all hours of darkness. Now, when it comes to lighting, Our organization espouses constant nighttime lighting supplemented by motion sensitive lighting. So your property should be well lit during evening, but if there is motion or activity there, then you get the extra blast of light from the motion sensitive lighting. And when we come out and recommend these particular types of light solutions, we are sensitive to light pollution and light trespass into neighboring homes. Now, the next thing on the perimeter layer would be barriers, fences, and or gates. In the crime prevention through environmental design concept, or SEPTED, we espouse fencing of the see-through variety, because solid fencing actually works to the benefit of the intruder, where if once they get over the barrier, they can work basically out of line of sight of neighbors and passersby. We talk about parking, and the parking is garage, outdoor, and on-street parking. I will talk a little bit more about that later on. The next thing with the perimeter layer would be that of landscaping. That would be trees, bushes, hedges, shrubbery, or other vegetation. Now, in the SEPTED concept, bushes, hedges should stand no taller than 3 feet. And the canopies of trees should hang no lower than 7 feet. That is to clear the line of sight around a location. One other thing that I may mention is that no tree, bush, hedge should block the view of a door or a window into your home. Now, a lot of people ask about security, plants, and shrubbery. There are advantages and disadvantages to utilizing those, and we would basically discuss those with you, the prickly types of plants, you know, but there are advantages, plus there are disadvantages to doing that. Now, when we start to talk about the building layer, basically what we're talking about is entry points, doors, windows, if you have skylights, hatch doors, vents underneath the dwelling, you know, to let the plumber in and things like that underneath the house. Now, remember, all doors should be of solid core construction and in good condition and tight fitting. They should be equipped with either a key and knob dead latch, lever handle dead latch, if you will, but security on an exterior door is provided by an auxiliary single cylinder deadbolt lock that's accompanied by a reinforced strike plate that is actually anchored to the 2x4 king studs in the wall behind the frame. If any of you have ever seen a door kicked in and you just see the frame kicked out, that means that the strike plate was not secured or anchored properly to the 2x4 king studs. So that is very important. Basically, the 1-inch throw, but what makes that deadbolt work is the strike plate. Now, let's talk about doors that have mail slots. You don't want to have an individual to be able to come up to your front door, either to your garage, raise the mail slot, and see the contents of either the house or the garage. So they're actually hood covers that you can purchase if you happen to have those particular mail slots in the door. And if you have a solid core entry door, we recommend a 180-degree wide angle door viewer. Yeah. All right. Now, let's talk about pet doors. A lot of people still have pet doors. Seal them, please. Any opening that is basically 96 inches in diameter, you know, a small adult or a child can get into. Now, here's the thing. The only thing on your body that won't bend is your head, your skull. If you can get your skull through it, you know, I can't, you know, because I have a little girth on me now, but anything you can get your head through, you can usually get the rest of your body through. So really pay attention to that. Okay. The other thing is, let me just allude to the garage for a second before we actually talk about the security. Normally on weekends when individuals are doing their I guess, weekly chores and airing out the house. You roll the garage door up and you go to the backyard, leaving the garage wide open for people walking down the street to see the contents of it. If you're in the garage and the door is open, stay in the garage. If you're going to go to the back of the house, side of the house, please close the garage door. You want to eliminate that enticement. We will talk further about those particular intrusions a little later. Now, let's talk about your garage to house door. That's for residential dwellings that have attached garages. The garage to house door should be treated the same as any other exterior door. It should be of solid core construction, tight fitting, and equipped with an auxiliary deadbolt locking device secured with that reinforced strike plate. Now, a lot of those particular garage to house doors open outward into the garage, which means that they have exterior hinges. So now if you have that good deadbolt on it, but if I can walk over and remove the hinge pins from the hinges, I can open the door on the hinge side. So there are methods that can be used to secure those. All right, let's go to windows. Now, all windows should be equipped with the factory install window lock. However, we recommend that two additional locks or auxiliary locks be used for those windows. A lot of people have the double hung windows or the old wood sash windows. They're sliding windows and also they're casements. So we're recommending two auxiliary locking device per opening part of a window. Now, for those of you who still have the old louvered windows, you know, the little slatted ones, they look really nice for ventilation and everything, replace them, because they're nightmares and you can remove those particular panels and enter a location. Now, let's talk specific to garage intrusions. Nowadays, what's happening is you will have individuals that will come up and bore a hole into the garage, and especially those that are constructed of wood. They will bore a hole, and once the garage is closed, there is that cord that hangs down right close to the door when the door is closed that is connected to the interior emergency release. So what we're recommending is either you remove that particular cord out of the way, because what happens is the hole is drilled, and then something similar to a clothes hanger is inserted. They grab the release cord, pull it through the hole, and then pull it down, and then the garage door can be eased up. Now, you have to think that when it is disengaged, the garage door motor is not working. You know, you're not going to hear any noise. They're just going to slide it up, and then they're going to be in, and then they're going to come out. So now there are flanges that can be installed where it blocks that release lever, but please do remove those particular cords and those little balls or whatever those little horizontal handles are, because you actually offer the intruder a way of grabbing it, pulling it, and releasing it. Now, the other thing about garage doors is the button openers that are there by the garage to house door. In a lot of older homes, you will have that button opener that's right up there on the interior on the garage frame, door frame. Okay. And you can insert an object in there and push that particular button. So you need to put a flange or a guard there to prevent the insertion of something between the garage door and the frame to get to that button. Okay. Now, let's
about 2 minutes. You have about 2 minutes.
All righty. And I'm winding up.
This is great. Great information.
Okay. Now, the interior layer. Okay. If you have a hot prowl or someone that decides to come into your home when it is occupied, here's the thing. You should have a safe room, a safe haven. It can be created out of a closet, out of a bedroom. But if an intruder comes in, you're there with your kids or your grandkids, You're going to want to be able to spirit them into a room that has a good solid core door on it, as well as a deadbolt lock, have a flashlight in case of power failure, and also have a phone. Now I'm getting a little long in the tooth and I'm old. I still have a landline, you know, and so it would be nice to have a landline in there, because in an emergency, you're going to grab the kids, run, and you'll probably leave that cell phone outside that room. So you need a way to call in law enforcement. Now, alarm systems are important. And lastly, let me just talk to you a bit about video surveillance. Worth its weight in gold for law enforcement. So if you're going to put up these particular cameras and, you know, any exposed area of your home, backyard, side or easement, and especially at the front of the house, and make sure that one camera points toward the address street. Lastly, the DA's office has a camera registry program that the police department relies on. If there's a criminal activity in an area, all the cameras in that area should be registered, because it will give the police additional information on cars, on whether or not the perpetrators went left or right, and it picks them up. So with that, I'm going to end by saying, please contact San Francisco Safe at sfsafe.org, and you can request a free residential security survey. And once your service request is on file, we will get back to you in 48 hours to attempt to schedule a day and a time to come out and survey your property. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. That's all great information. And I must admit, I hadn't thought about the idea of making sure your address can be seen from the street, because I don't think mine is. So that's something I'm going to certainly be going out and getting. Our next, there'll be questions for everybody later. So we're going to go through the four speakers first. Our next speaker is Lieutenant Clayton Harmston from the Terrevale Police District.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Great. Well, thank you very much for having me. It's great to take this opportunity to meet the different community groups in the Terrevale District. Just a little bit about me. This is my third time working at the Terrevale District Station. 20 years ago, as a young officer, I was here on patrol. And then subsequently, when I promoted to sergeant, I had the opportunity to come back here and do my probationary work here in the Terrevale, and now I'm back as a lieutenant. So it's kind of like feels like home in a certain way. So I really am excited to be here and part of the community again. So my portion will be concentrating on some of the crime statistics relative to the Terrevale Police District. And so I'm going to give you a year-to-date statistics, and then I can also break it down into monthly comparison in the major property crimes and person crimes categories. So auto thefts, colloquially known as larcenies, year to date from January until our latest reporting period, which is in April of this year, shows 32% decrease in auto thefts and larcenies. The raw numbers that I was given is 344 for the year, as compared to 505 incidents reported to us last year. Monthly, for the month of April this year, it looks like there was a slight increase, 4%. We've had 86 incidents as compared to 83 incidents for this time period last year in April. Going on to robberies from person, year to date down 5%, 41 from January until April 30th, as opposed to last year, reporting period was 43 incidents. So the monthly comparison shows a 17% increase. However, the raw numbers are 5 incidences for the month of April, as opposed to 6 incidences April 2020. Next, we have residential burglaries and also commercial burglaries. They group them in together for an overall statistic. And this is where we are facing a challenge, as you probably all are aware. Year to date, it shows an up increase of 91%. And I'll give you the raw numbers showing from January of this year till April, 210 reported incidents. And the same reporting period last year in 2020 was 110. Monthly comparison, we've had 38 burglary incidences for the month of April, and then compared to 31 incidences last year. The two other categories I'm gonna go over is the aggravated assaults and motor vehicle thefts. So aggravated assaults, we are breaking even with 37 incidences so far this year and 37 same reporting period last year. So for this month, for aggravated assault incidences, we've had 7 in April 2021, as opposed to 4 April 2020. Let me try to silence that, sorry. Okay, and then lastly here is motor vehicle thefts. Year to date, up 15%. We've had 198 instances, as opposed to last year, January to April 2020, 172. And then the monthly breakdown is we are up 23% for vehicle thefts. We have 34 in the month of April this year, they're down 23%. 34 incidences this year, and then last year in April, it was 44. And then lastly, Officer Benny Liu provided me with the statistics for the catalytic converter thefts for the month of April, and that's 16. And unfortunately, I don't have the last April's total, but that'll give you the raw number for this year. So it's kind of a mixed bag. Some categories are down and some categories are up in these different crime statistics. I can tell you that the SFPD and Terrible included, we use it's called intelligence based reporting. So what we do is every week we compile crime statistics for the various areas of the Terrible district, and so we can have it plotted on our crime maps, and we use that to formulate how we redistribute our resources, our sector cars, so we can concentrate on those areas that see an uptick in a certain crime category, so we can address those issues, hopefully proactively. What we've been doing is our station investigative team, which comprises our detectives that are assigned to our station here, they put out a weekly intel report internally for our officers, so they can be aware of the different crime trends in their individual car sectors. It's very important that our officers who have dedicated car sectors and dedicated partners, that they know where the crimes are occurring so that they can address those issues as they arise. Okay, I noticed that there's a lot of questions that were submitted, and I guess we're gonna go over those at the end. I can address some of those concerns as well. But those are the overall picture of where we're at so far from January until April of this year.
Thank you. Can you just actually briefly, how many officers are assigned to Terrible? How many are out on, foot patrols or in cars and that sort of thing? Just general how what the staffing issues look like.
Sure. So we're pretty well staffed right now, I would say. We have approximately 86 patrol officers currently at the station, and they're divvied out between our day watch, which primarily works 6 a.m. till about 4 p.m., and then on our swing watch, we have approximately 21 officers, and then about the same number on midnights. And then there's the usual captain staff officers, and then we also have what's called our plainclothes team, which consists of six officers and one sergeant that supervises them. And so right now we're pretty well staffed as far as that goes. Now, there are in the Terravel six car sectors, and so each car sector we try to fill with two officers per. And depending on staffing levels any particular day, we might have to run a single officer for that for a particular car sector. But fortunately, that's kind of rare. We're able to maintain staffing levels sufficient to answer calls for service and keep up with the call volume. And I'm sorry, what was the other question?
That was it. I guess it was a question of how many cars. So if there's six car sectors, that means there's six cars out at any one time?
There could be if we're fully staffed for that day. So for instance, tonight, I'm the swing watch platoon commander. So I supervise the watch between 3 p.m. and roughly midnight. And so for tonight, we have four car sectors that are fully staffed. And then once on their downtime, say a particular car sector isn't on a call for service or on patrol in their car sector, they go to their neighboring car sector that might not be staffed as well. So they cover both. And also if there's call for service in those car sectors, then they will handle it because they're the neighboring car sector.
Okay.
And then also we have gone to it's called a platooning schedule, which basically splits. Like I mentioned, there's 21 officers on swing watch. So for instance, tonight we'll have 10 working on my side of the week. On the other side of the week, the other lieutenant will have an additional 11 on his side. So he divvies out his officers amongst the different car sectors. And on Wednesday is our double day. So there's a lot of officers working. So what we try to do is give them the opportunity to do some training, because obviously there's more officers than car sectors that need to be staffed. So we'll offer training to these officers that they wouldn't otherwise be able to get because we have free time. And then also we'll take the opportunity to augment those car sectors that might not be filled with those officers that are here for the double day. We call it a double day. So on those days, it's really great. We have plenty of officers.
Okay. And there's a question in the chat. Do you use like bait bicycles or bait cars, you know, packages in cars and that sort of thing?
Yes, we have. And for that, we use our plainclothes unit. They're called TNT, the Terravel Neighborhood Team. And what they'll do is they'll have one of those electric rental bikes that you see. Or they'll have a really high-end, expensive mountain bike or racing bike that they will set up in different locations. And what we'll do is we'll, using our intelligence-led policing to figure out where these incidents are really occurring, then we'll address it with that. We'll use the bait operation with that.
Oh, okay. Great. Thank you. Our next speaker is... Supervisor Myrna Melgar, are you on?
I am. I'm here, Sally.
Oh, great. Welcome.
Thank you so much. And thank you, Lieutenant Harmston and Mr. Wyatt, for those amazing presentations. I took a lot of notes, Mr. Wyatt. That was very practical and very detailed. So thank you. So I will start by just telling you a little bit about what our office has been up to in the areas of public safety and stopping crime. I wanted to first introduce Lila Carrillo, who is on this call right now. I don't know if Lila, you can wave, but she is in our office in charge of everything to do with public safety. So she is our liaison to the police stations that serve all of the neighborhoods in the district, and also to the district attorney and the criminal justice system offices that interact with the police. And so Lila's the person that you want to reach out to, there she is, if you want to communicate with us about any specific areas of concern. So if you haven't seen it already, we put out a chunk of change for the community this year. Instead of participatory budgeting because of COVID, you know, it's difficult to be getting signatures from your neighbors, and City Hall's not open. So we decided to have a very shortened process by which the community could access this money. And we have four priority areas: community resiliency, public safety, disaster preparedness, and community recovery. So these are going to be grants between $10,000 and $25,000 that are for people who have already gotten participatory budgeting awards. And I know Sharp has done this in the past, working with SF Safe. So if you've already gotten cameras, you can get money for additional cameras or anything to add on to what you already have. The applications are actually due tomorrow. However, if you haven't started working on it, please don't be intimidated, because it's a very simple Google form. And we already have all your information if you've already gotten the participatory budgeting award before. So for the public safety activities, what we're looking for is anything that will add to the capacity of the community to like stay safe. So cameras, whistles, safety kits, volunteer support, volunteer training, management, all of those things. And people have gotten actually pretty creative in how they are leveraging the resources and the knowledge of the community and neighbors to stay safe and keep eyes on the street and use technology to support safety. So for next year, we expect to have a full participatory budgeting process where if you are thinking of something, you know, bigger than what you have right now, you know, we will go through the whole process and you can apply there. But the money that is available right now is going to be quick, and we hope to have it awarded by the end of the fiscal year, which is June. So aside from the resources to support the community's efforts, we have been working with Captains Rainsford, Perea, and Jones, and Pedrini to support their efforts, and we're in constant communication with them. Actually, Captain Pedrini had an excellent idea that I pitched to the mayor for keeping folks safer up on Twin Peaks on Christmas Tree Point, which has been a place where there's been a lot of crime since the closure of the streets to car traffic. And, you know, I do consider the relationship that we have with the staff at the stations really essential in helping us sort of craft good policy, put resources to where they're needed, and constantly sort of keep our eyes and our ears on the street of what folks need to keep the community safe. Other than that, you know, we are going into budget season. I am working with Chief Scott to support his needs in terms of implementing the Department of Justice recommendations for our police department, including most importantly, their need for data capacity to be able to track what they're doing and support his work. And so stay tuned, but that's something that we're going right into. And I will be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Great, thank you very much. The next speaker, and then we'll get kind of questions all after Is the next speaker is Nancy Tung from Stop Crime San Francisco.
Hi, Sally. Good evening, everyone. I'm so happy to be here to speak to you about Stop Crime SF and the work that we're doing. So for those of you who aren't familiar with Stop Crime, it's a basically a criminal justice accountability group. We are really focused on crime and how to not only prevent crime and keep our neighbors informed about crime that's happening in the neighborhood, but also about holding responsible and accountable our elected leaders for issues involving crime. We have a few marquee programs and things that we do. We've put up video cameras and surveillance cameras in neighborhoods through participatory budgeting in the past. And one of our most important programs is one that's called Court Watch. And this is where we monitor the judicial system in San Francisco to make sure that cases don't fall through the cracks. We are advocates for victims through our Court Watch program, where we send volunteers to monitor and make sure that we understand what's happening in cases. Particularly a few years ago, we were following a serial auto burglar in his case in court, and it actually attracted quite a bit of media attention, which then allowed us to make sure that the judge didn't basically sentence him to less than what he actually really deserved because of his repeat behavior. And it really brings kind of to light how important it is for the community to be aware of these cases and what's going on in the criminal justice system, because otherwise there's no accountability. So we monitor judges, we monitor the DA's office and the public defender's office. We hold supervisors accountable for choices that they've made in terms of legislation. We lobby them from time to time. And we also, talk about the police department as well. One of the things that we are concerned about right now and that we are trying to activate people on is the issues around police budgeting, which I think is coming up in the Board of Supervisors now. It's really important that we have a robust budget for the police department, even as some of the functions are getting peeled off like mental health response, which also is important that we take a view towards mental health that is addressed in a way that keeps everybody safe, but that we also have enough budgetary resources for the police department for them to continue to do their work. And I think in a time when we have more and more demands of the police department to de-escalate, to take more time on calls, to do more community policing, that we also need to recognize that we cannot have a better police department when we don't have adequate investment. So these are the kind of the things that Stop Crime is engaged in. We're also starting some new initiatives about publishing fact-based news articles and leading public education campaigns. We also do support reform in the criminal justice system, including police and prison reforms that increase safety for all. Most importantly, we're about making rational choices about how to keep our community safe for everybody. And if you're interested in finding out more about Stop Crime, I'm gonna pop our website in the chat. We're always looking for people to engage, to volunteer with our group, to join our board. And we're happy to be here and talk about the things that we're doing.
Great, thank you very much. So we have some questions. As I said at the very beginning, both Golden Gate Heights Neighborhood Association and SHARP contributed some questions, and people when they registered contributed questions. And again, feel free to add any questions into the chat. Not every question will be asked. Unfortunately, there's just not enough time. but we'll try to get to as many as we can. And the speakers pretty much anyone who, if you, any of the four speakers, if you'd like to respond, you certainly can. We sort of ask that you kind of limit your response to at 3 minutes, just to try to keep things moving along as much as we can. So the first question I'll ask is the rash of garage break-ins and robberies. What can or should be done to stop that rash of garage break-ins and robberies? Mr. Wyatt talked about things you can do in your garage to make it harder for them to do it. But I think this is looking at a broader issue of are these, you know, organized networks of people that are doing it? Are they, is it all crimes of opportunity? Is it they, you know, they look and they see, you know, that sort of thing. So just in general, what can or should be done to stop the rash of garage break-ins and robberies?
Why don't we start with Supervisor Melgar and then Lieutenant Harmston.
Okay, well, I mean, you know, I am not an expert on crime policy, so I will defer to my friend Nancy Tung, who is an expert and actually, you know, thought to be our DA. All I can say is, yes, we should stop them and we should support the policies that have evidence behind them that they work. And so I think Nancy in her presentation did list a couple of those things. And, you know, what I can say as a sort of policymaker that I will support those things that have been proven to lead to success in stopping those behaviors that hurt others.
Well, thank you, Supervisor Melgar. You know, my background actually is as a prosecutor. I've been a prosecutor for more than 20 years at this point. It is, from what I understand, a smaller amount of people that are committing these types of auto burglaries in you know, when we were talking about maybe in 2019, but also residential burglaries. So it's not just a one-for-one that you have one suspect that is committing a single residential burglary, but it's actually people who continue to do it, and only once they're caught that it becomes an opportunity, number one, for intervention, but also number two, for us to be able to have an impact on public safety. I don't know if the lieutenant can speak to whether or not there are any kind of statistics around how many people are actually creating the harm when it comes to residential burglaries. But certainly I think that when we are talking about public safety, that we need to talk also about making sure that we have a robust criminal justice system where people are actually held accountable so that when cases come in, they have an effect of punishing and then rehabilitating the person who's been charged with the crime and has been proven to commit the crime, but also that it has a deterrent effect for anyone else who thinks that it's a San Francisco is an easy mark and that you should, instead of, you know, committing a crime in San Mateo County or Marin County or Alameda County, that it's, you're much better off trying to come to San Francisco, which I think has been the reputation for a number of years at this point.
Yes, I can, to piggyback on what Nancy was saying, I have seen an increase over the past few years with regard to residential burglaries and auto burglaries as well. There is a large portion of those offenders that we find come from outside of San Francisco. That's not to say that we don't have our own homegrown criminals that break into houses and break into cars, but there has been a large number from various areas in the East Bay that come over and commit crimes, and then they'll commit numerous crimes in different police districts. We've seen that a lot. So they'll, for instance, they'll start in the central and then work their way through the city, hit the Mission, and then they'll end up either here or in the Richmond district, and then they'll take off. And we know that because we have the same suspect descriptions using the same car that will hit in one location. And then those officers will put out the description. And then 20 minutes later, that same car and that same crew will hit another location in a different part of the city. And those officers in that district will put out the same suspect description information. And to, I guess, back up what Mr. Wyatt was saying about cameras, they are invaluable. Because when our investigators, whether it be at the burglary detail or at the station level investigations, we rely on those cameras to identify suspects, get good pictures of them, and also license plates of these vehicles so that we can track where they're coming from. Are they coming from the East Bay to do their crimes here? Are they coming from the South Bay? A lot of them are rental vehicles, believe it or not. So having good video is invaluable, because what we'll do is we'll take those really good still videos, take pictures, and we'll create crime bulletins, which can be distributed to all the members of the SFPD. And we also have a network of Bay Area agencies where we can blast out these crime bulletins to our neighboring agencies in South Bay, East Bay, North Bay. Because inevitably, these crews are not only hitting here, they're also hitting in other jurisdictions as well, so we can build cases on them. So to answer your question, it's kind of a mixed bag, but I would say over the years, I've seen an increase in people from outside San Francisco coming in.
Do you have a sense of how many people have been arrested versus how many have been charged for especially break-ins?
So when we arrest an individual or even a crew, I have noticed that they are out on probation, either in the city or in another jurisdiction. And a lot of times they're on probation for the same offense, unfortunately. So we see the same small population of individuals doing these crimes. It's not like there's a large population out there of criminals invading the city. It's a relatively small portion of the same repeat offenders that we see. When we do make arrests, we book them, and then that case is assigned to an inspector or a sergeant who prepares the case to present to the DA's office for charging decisions. Now, a lot of the times, we rely on good video to assist the DA's office in recharging these cases where we have a lot of really good evidence against the people that we do catch. Now, what happens to them after that? That's outside of my wheelhouse. I can tell you that I know that some suspects that are arrested, depending on their criminal history, might be discharged to probation. If they're already on probation, the DA's office will violate their probation, revoke their probation, and send them back to jail for a small amount of time. There's different things that can be done at the DA's office. But like I said, once we make the arrest, we put the case together with the video, with the eyewitnesses, and we present it to the DA's office for a charging decision. It sounds like Ms. Tung, you've had some experience at the DA's office, so you know exactly what I'm kind of talking about.
Yeah, exactly. So the stronger the case is that the police department brings to a DA's office, the better or easier time that it is to prosecute the case. Certainly there are a lot of considerations that come into play, whether or not it's a first-time offense or a person's criminal history, whether or not there are some other factors that might contribute to the person's criminal behavior, such as drugs or alcohol or some other situations. But I think that the DA's office should be really working hand in hand with the police department in order to take down organized groups that are committing a large portion of the crimes. and certainly making sure that offenders are held responsible.
Piggybacking on this discussion a little bit, it appears that the DA's office wants to focus on diversion programs, not prosecutions, and sometimes even for violent offenders, depending on the case. Supervisor Melgar and then others, do you support this approach, and why or why not?
I think that our district attorney has a agenda that he was with when he was running. I have had conversations with him about specific things that have happened in our district, in the decisions that the office made as applied to those things that have happened. For example, death of a young father on Lake Merced Boulevard in February. We are getting ready to put out our own findings about that case. We asked the district attorney about what, you know, the policy that you just spoke to, Sally, from a point of contention or challenging whether it was right or wrong, but rather looking at the results of what happened. Because I think at the end of the day, all of us who are in public office need to be held accountable for the results that we produce. And so in our investigations, we did ask folks from the CHP, from adult probation, from the police department, from the sheriff, how they interacted with the district attorney's office. And, you know, what we found is that, you know, whatever policy the district attorney has repercussions on all those other agencies. And that, you know, for the public safety and for the accountability that the public and also, you know, the perpetrators, you know, deserve in terms of fairness and justice, there needs to be consistency and that agencies have to work together and be accountable to one another. I'm not sure that happened in the cases that you know, we've asked about. And I think that, you know, the results are what we need to hold people accountable to. So to answer your question, I don't know if what he's doing is working. I don't know if the policy is working. And I think at the end of the day, you know, the district attorney, like everyone else who is elected, is accountable.
Thank you. I'm going to ask the next question. I'm going to start with Supervisor Melgar. What does police reform mean to you?
Hi, Frank.
What changes? Hi. What changes do you want to see made in policing in San Francisco? And then we'll follow that up with the other speakers.
Yeah. So to me, police reform has a map already in San Francisco. We've been working at it for a while. Both community folks and the folks at the police department have been working on a map, and the outline was provided by the Justice Department in a bunch of recommendations that they made that we have actually implemented the majority of. So to me, you know, there's the sort of the specific tools that need to be implemented. And there's also a cultural change that is happening, not just in our police department, but at police departments all over the country about the things that, you know, Nancy had referred to earlier about, you know, mental health and, you know, who responds to what. Now, I think that for me, police reform is also building those other systems. And I am acutely aware that we have not yet built them. And so we can talk about, you know, mental health responses, and we can talk about, alternatives to incarceration that support people towards success. And I do support all of those things. I want to make sure that people have a chance to succeed. However, they're sort of empty promises until we actually do it, and we have not built a lot of those systems. So if we are operating under an assumption that we are going to build it someday, but in the now, folks are struggling and presenting a danger to others, then I think it's our responsibility to make sure that the public is safe.
Great, thank you. Nancy Tung, would you like to respond? Can you unmute her, please, Sophia? There you go.
So I wanted to actually kind of dovetail on Supervisor Milgar's, the question that was posed to her previously about diversions that Sally asked. And, I think there is a time and a place for diversion in the criminal justice system. And for those of you who don't know the concept of it, it basically is a way to have some accountability for the offender without permanently impacting their record with a conviction. Some people consider diversion as a form of restorative justice where, the person who commits the offense can really get to a point where they understand what the harm is and understand what the harm is to the community and to make amends for that. And I think it's appropriate in some types of lower level offenses, nonviolent crimes, and certainly, they've taken an approach toward juveniles that incorporates diversions and kind of the restorative justice, these issues. Where I think that it has kind of gone awry is when you talk about serious and violent crimes, especially crimes against vulnerable populations in San Francisco. And a couple of the cases that Stop Crime has been following with respect to crimes that have been committed against elders in the Asian American community have gone to diversion, and not just while there may be concerns about a person's mental health, whether or not they have some issues that need to be addressed, and it can be addressed through the court system. In my mind, diversion is not an appropriate place for someone who has committed a serious or violent crime against an elder. And so there needs to be some type of tighter control over a person and some accountability, which can be had and address their mental health issues while not just kind of giving them a watered down approach in terms of, here's this diversion and now you're done. With respect to, I'm sorry, Frank, what was the last question that you asked? It was about...
The last question was about police reform.
Police reform. So, Supervisor Milgar is correct that the police department is actively engaged in I think there are 272 reforms that were suggested by President Obama's commission on reform when they looked at the San Francisco Police Department. And there has been some progress made, but we're one presidential administration beyond Obama and now into a new one. And I hope that the police commission and the police department continue to make progress on those reforms. One of the things that I have heard a lot from community members is that, in addition to kind of use of force reforms and different aspects of day-to-day policing, one of the things that the community really wants to see is more community policing. And so what this means to me is that, that there are police officers who are actively engaged in interacting with the community, foot beats. We often talk about foot beats and how Many residents would like to see more foot beats on commercial corridors. This idea that, you know, police officers should be guardians of the community and not necessarily warriors in the community, but they're actually more integrated, that people know who the police officers are, that that are policing their neighborhoods, that there is an understanding of who lives in a place and who works in a place and the needs of the community in terms of language services and cultural competency from police officers. I think those are really important parts of reform as well, so that we integrate the police department very much within the fabric of the community. And I know that the department is trying to do that as well.
Great. Lieutenant Harmson and Mr. Wyatt, do you have anything you'd like to add about police reform?
No, not at present. They've pretty much covered it.
Thank you.
Yes, I'd just like to add on to what Ms. Tong was talking about, guardian mindset. When I started 20 years ago, it was a different mindset. I never heard the term warrior, but in effect, that's what it was, war on crime. And we were seen as the ones holding that line between chaos and, order. Today, while that's certainly something we need to always guard against, the department has gone in a new direction, and I think nationally as well, to the guardian mindset. We do have training now, it's called Blue Courage, that most of our agency has gone through, and it inculcates that ethos of guardianship, that we are guardians of the community, as Plato said thousands of years ago, that the police are the guardians. But with that, I want to add that we still have to have that warrior when we need to be, because there are violent people out there that prey upon the citizens, and we are guardians, but when called upon, we have to be warriors as well in protecting our communities. It's a little bit nuanced for me. And as far as police reform, I know that San Francisco Police Department is leaps and bounds ahead of a lot of agencies nationwide. When we hear police reform being talked about on the news, a lot of these concepts that people are clamoring for on the national level, we've already done here in San Francisco, and we are already implementing. Those DOJ recommendations are being implemented at a breakneck pace right now. I can tell you that. There's a lot of changes happening internally and a lot of new training coming out. And a lot of, newer officers are being educated in the new way that we're going to be policing, how we're going to reimagine policing going on in the future.
Can you give us a couple of examples of how training has changed or how a few of the recommendations have been implemented?
So the biggest thing right now is the de-escalation. I can tell you that it's very, very big push right now for us to de-escalate situations when we can. Of course, when something is happening in a split second, sometimes you don't have time to de-escalate, but the majority of the time, when somebody is up here emotionally, we have to do our best to bring them down. When I was trained many years ago, when a suspect is up here, we have to match him up here. Well, you don't always have to do that. There's a time and place for that. So creating time and distance, we don't have to rush in all the time and make a situation even more inflamed if we don't have to. A lot of times that helps. Creating that time to sit back, take a bigger picture of what's happening in that situation, and formulate a plan before our officers go in and execute that plan to resolve the situation peacefully. Now, with that being said, of course, when something is happening split second, you have to make the call and you have to go in and take action immediately. But when you can, which is the majority of the time, We are encouraging and training officers to just take a breath, take a tactical breath, and see what's really happening in this situation and see if there's a different way we can resolve it. That's the biggest thing, I think. And then just a cultural change and the guardian mindset.
Thank you. That's very explicit. I appreciate that. Mm-hmm. Very specific. Some people have said that not only in San Francisco, but in other cities across the country, that we should have mental health and crisis social workers answering some calls instead of police. Supervisor Melgar has recognized that, we've started, I think we have 3 or 4 teams now, but we don't have most of the systems in place. Do you envision that you would cut police patrols when those mental health teams are implemented, supervisor? Or do you think that we need to have both?
I think we need to have both. I think that, it is an academic question for me right now, because we don't have the system fully formed out. I think the last report I got, we had 14 members of that, a group of folks, right. And they're operating during very limited hours. As Lieutenant Harmston knows, this kind of stuff, people go into crisis at all hours of the day and night, not within, a specific shift. And so we need to have a system that responds to people in crisis, to domestic violence, to kids, to all of the different ways in which people struggle in our city. We have asked a lot of our police in doing that, plus being guardians and sometimes warriors. I really like that language, Nancy. Thank you. That was a really good way of framing it. We don't yet have it, as you stated, Frank. And I think that our budget is $13.5 billion a year in San Francisco. And I think that, we do need to look at where our resources go. I think the police department is one of the departments. It's not the only department.
Thank you.
If I could say something about that, Frank, too.
Please.
The issue around mental health, I think we're seeing it more and more on our streets every day. And I'll relay a personal, an event that happened this week, actually, in my neighborhood. One of my neighbors was dealing with a family member who was having a mental health issue, and standing outside of his home, yelling for about an hour, some very strong language, obscenities, and also some threatening language. And my neighbor, despite the fact that this was a family member and somebody that he regarded as a son, called the police, and the police did not show up for over an hour. And by the time they actually did show up, he had been gone for, maybe 5 minutes at that point in time. I think there is a very important place for those mental health intervention teams in response to 911 calls, because the community needs that. But not every 911 call needs to have a police response right away. And I'm not saying that there is never a situation where some situation like this, where it's a family dispute that involves also mental health issues, where it might escalate into something where there needs to be a police response. But we do need to have that initial response that can de-escalate and address the mental health issues. And then number two, we also need to have the police department available if those issues cannot be resolved and the situation escalates. And so in my mind, when we are asking more of our police department in terms of the way that they address calls that they go out to in order to protect the safety of not just the surrounding community, but also of the officers who are putting their lives on the line every day by going to work, that we do have the resources for the police department to actually do the job we want them to do and that we're asking them to do.
I wanted to add something, if that's okay. Hey, Frank, let me just add one thing to what you're so great, Nancy. But I, you know, this conversation is in the context of stopping crime. And, you know, mental health are a small section of, you know, crime in even that. And so I don't like it that we're talking about either police or mental health as if it was like one or the other, because it should be both. And in fact, you know, mental health and the lack thereof affects a lot more than just crime. It affects our schools, it affects children, it affects families, it affects all kinds of aspects of our society that we want to make sure our citizens have, you know, a path towards success. And so, you know, part of mental health right now is being handled by the Department of Public Health. Certainly drug abuse, drug prevention, alcohol prevention, all of those things that have to do with mental health fall under the Department of Public Health. It's not, you know, from the police budget. In fact, we just had a hearing about Medicare reimbursement for mental health and supporting drug abuse and drug abuse prevention. And so I don't know that I want to say it's either one or the other, or we take resources from there, because we definitely need both. And we need to have mental health supports for much more than just, stopping crime.
So last year, the budget for the police was cut $60 million. That's for a two-year period, I believe. Would you support restoring part of that money for the coming year or further cuts?
You know, the mayor comes out with her budget on June 1st. And so I haven't seen what she is proposing. She has the authority to, you know, propose a budget, and we have only the authority of adding back stuff. So it will be a negotiation with, the other 10 members of the Board of Supervisors and the mayor, whose, decisions I usually support. I also have been in talks with Chief Scott. And like I said, there are a couple of things that I have told him that I will support him on. One of them is the need for data systems at the police department that support the work they're trying to do. It's inexcusable that in the middle of Silicon Valley, our police still like does things by paper, and they don't have the resources to have a database that talks to other areas of the criminal justice system. And the other thing that I will support is a police academy. The last year, we cut two classes, and I think that it is the opposite of what we're supposed to be doing, given the Justice Department recommendations of training and professional developments for our officers.
Thank you. Nancy, do you want to comment on that?
No, I think that Supervisor Melgar said it exactly right. You know, we need to support mental health programs, and we also need to support the police. And, one of the things that I worry about from time to time, and maybe Lieutenant Harmston can talk about this a little bit, is, the future of staffing in the San Francisco Police Department. In terms of retirements and the ability to recruit and retain qualified people to be police officers in San Francisco. I know that there has been a real struggle in years past, and that a significant portion of the department is eligible for retirement in the next few years. The question in my mind is oftentimes, how are we going to replace people who are retiring, and how are we going to recruit people into the academy that are qualified? Because I think the washout rate is probably higher than anybody wants to hear, because it's a significant investment for San Francisco to put people through an academy class. And then in addition to that, when people are certified to be police officers, then it's very easy to be lured away into another jurisdiction because police departments all over the Bay Area are hiring. They're offering bonuses to people. And so when you train up an officer and then, you know, put them on the street for a couple of years and then they get recruited away, there goes the investment that San Francisco has put into that person.
Good point. Lieutenant Harmston mentioned that a lot of the people who are coming into San Francisco to commit crimes, particularly on the west side in terms of robberies and burglaries and motor vehicle thefts, are people who don't live in San Francisco. Some people say that any action we take to address social issues in San Francisco in order to reduce crime would have very little impact on criminals who don't live here and who wouldn't benefit from whatever we do. How would you deal with that?
So the question is about social interventions?
Social interventions, income, equity problems. The question really isn't directed at you. It's more of a policy question, but feel free to jump in if you'd like to respond.
Well, as far as crime and those who commit crime that live in the city, sure, yes, we need to have robust social services and address those issues. Why are they committing crime? Is it economics? Is it some sort of substance abuse problem, mental health problems? Of course, we can tackle those problems here in the city. But for those that come from outside of San Francisco in to commit crimes, that's something that we in San Francisco can't really have an impact on per se. I mean, if somebody lives in the East Bay or the South Bay, those types of issues have to be addressed by those local jurisdictions. Maybe it's sure. A statewide problem that needs to be looked at. But there's a reason why they're coming to San Francisco and committing multiple break-ins.
Sure.
I'd like to add Supervisor. To that, that once a person has been convicted of a crime in San Francisco, if they are placed on probation, the probation is transferred to the county where they reside. So, in terms of, social programs in San Francisco that address maybe the root causes of criminality, I think there are that our city government is trying to be forward-looking by putting into place preventative types of things. And the same goes with the state. So one of the programs that has some investment in San Francisco and gives grants to nonprofits in San Francisco is a statewide program called CalVIP. It's Violence Intervention Program. And they give funds and grants to organizations that operate locally to prevent gun violence. And there are a number of community organizations in San Francisco that do that type of intervention work. So in terms of that being like a social services program, that's one avenue. And I do also know that the mayor's office allocated, I think it was $2 million to a consortium of API community-based organizations for that type of work as well. So intervening in levels of trauma to address victims of crime and different levels of support for people who have experienced crime. So these types of programs I think are important. How they interact with the criminal justice system. If the question is more about, putting in place rehabilitation programs specifically in San Francisco for offenders who are not in San Francisco, I think there is some benefit to that as well, even if they don't live here. It's just a question, like, of balance, as I think many things are in the criminal justice system.
Okay, thank you. Supervisor?
So I think, you know, Nancy answered that question about whether somebody who doesn't live here commits a crime here and, you know, is transferred somewhere else. I think that there's two different buckets of how I'm looking at this, Frank. One is a policy and the other is implementation. And I think that, you know, the best thought through policies, if we don't have good implementation mechanisms, are not going to work. And so I am really interested in identifying the diversion programs, the social service programs, the prevention programs that have good evidence of rehabilitating people in making sure that the connections that made are made, that people don't fall through the cracks, that, you know, when somebody is on probation or in a program, that, you know, it actually happens and not that we just release them without any mechanisms of keeping track of where people are or supporting them in actually, completing rehabilitation or whatever it is that they're doing. Because if we do that, we're actually failing both society and the person that we are trying to support. Sure. So I think that as policymakers, we have to look at both, right? Does the policy that we're implementing have evidence behind it? Is it sound? And two, do we have the capacity of the systems to make sure that it is done successfully and that at the end of the day, it succeeds to people?
Great. Okay. Thank you. I'm going to get very local. We had a question about putting in a stop sign at 10th Avenue and Pacheco. It has the support of our So again, I didn't hear your response.
There she is. I knew where that question was coming from.
It was not me. It was not my question.
Okay.
Yeah. The area in question has had four accidents in the last month, and there have been a number of small crashes and larger crashes over the years, and it's supported by both Sharp and Golden Heights Neighborhood Association, as well as a lot of the neighbors.
We're working on it. The MTA has been very frustrating. I think that within the next week, we're going to have a resolution. I have been on the phone most of the afternoon with folks. I think that, the Board of Supervisors does have the ultimate decision-making authority for any appeals from the neighbors. I hope it doesn't come to that. I hope that we can just resolve it, because it makes sense. we can just do it. If it comes to that, I think eventually we will get the stop signs.
One more very local question. Thank you for that response. A neighbor had people in the middle of the night try to burn his house down, and he asked this question. He and his wife and his child in the middle of the night woke up in time, and they got out, and they were able to suppress the fire to some extent. But broken windows policing refers to enforcement for low-level antisocial and criminal behaviors. We're talking about public urination, vandalism, graffiti, dumping trash, shoplifting. Advocates say that targeting these kinds of violations deters more serious criminal activity like arsons and home break-ins. They say it engages the minor criminals early with justice or mental health systems and support systems, giving them a chance to turn their lives around. Do you support broken windows policing, and why or why not?
I mean, like I said, this is outside my area of expertise. I think this may be a question for the lieutenant.
Yeah, it's really a policy question, but feel free, Lieutenant.
Oh, okay. these types of philosophies on crime suppression and crime prevention, while they certainly do have a dramatic effect on bringing down crime, one has to also be aware of the possibility or the likelihood of over-policing certain populations. And so that's always on our mind with regards to taking maximum enforcement for these low-level offenses. So for instance, you know, minor littering or urinating in public, a lot of times officers only have to contact the person and, you know, give a verbal warning or say, hey, look, you know, this is your community. You know, you have to look out for your own community. And that's where that guardian mindset comes in with the police, you know, educating and saying, hey, this is not right. You know, and there might be extenuating circumstances. Maybe somebody didn't have a place to go to the bathroom. They're homeless. Maybe there is a reason why they're committing these low level offenses. Now, things like vandalism, literal broken windows. I would argue that's something that needs to be taken a little more seriously, because that's destroying somebody's personal property, private property. But for the other low-level things, a lot of times, this is where community policing comes in, and just having a contact with the person and talking to them. And, you know, and if it continues, if the behavior continues, then enforcement can be also used as one of our tools in our tool belt. But to blanket, go back to the days of broken windows where it's maximum enforcement for every petty thing, I wouldn't agree with that. It's a very nuanced approach that we need to take.
And I would add to that, you know, we have limited resources with our police department. And so, you know, if you have that maximum enforcement approach, then that takes away police officers from, you know, more serious crimes that are occurring. And we need to really make sure that we have an appropriate response for, you know, the seriousness of the crime. So, you know, I think that, you know, and I've seen it too, like a police contact is all that needs to be done in order to stop the behavior from happening. Certainly if it extends into, you know, a mental health issue, somebody who's committing repeat low-level crimes because of a mental health issue, then there's a different approach for that than somebody who's just, you know, urinating on the street because they don't have a bathroom.
Sure.
Yeah, I think we're trying to be respectful of everyone's time. And so I think we have time for maybe one more question. And it's a, you know, kind of a slight change in direction, but what is being done or should be done to stop the rash of hate crimes, and in particular those targeting Asian Americans?
Well, I think this is a really nuanced question, because there's a lot of cultural issues that come into play when you talk about the AAPI population. You know, there are a lot of immigrants, you know, people whose families immigrated a long time ago and people whose families immigrated very recently. There are language barriers, there may be distrust of governments or distrust of the police. And so, you know, this cultural competency that goes along with policing and language competency, those are important key factors in, number one, reporting crime to the police. Because I think there are a couple of things at play, that Asian Americans may be targeted because of some stereotypical beliefs that they are weak, that they won't fight back, that they carry a lot of valuable possessions, and they won't report the crime to the police, and so nothing will happen. And there are, you know, we have to change that mindset and we also have to change that perception. So I think that, you know, this recent wave of hate crimes or crimes against the Asian American community, Part of what has been very an important catalyst has been coverage by the media, and awareness in the public about crimes that are occurring in, you know, in our neighborhoods in San Francisco, very serious crimes that have kind of risen to the top. And, you know, I'll say this much. Today, I actually saw something really refreshing in the news that, you know, there was an elderly woman, Asian woman, who was being robbed, but that there were two bystanders who came to her aid and actually, you know, confront. I wouldn't necessarily recommend this for everyone, but, you know, a security guard who confronted the person who was committing the crime, who had committed the robbery and the assault, and that actually engaged and wanted to protect this person in their community. And I think, you know, without the publicity that has come along in the last year or so because of, you know, crimes against the Asian American community, that maybe we wouldn't have had such a response in the past. So I think things are changing, but, you know, to stop the crimes from happening, we need to have prosecution, arrests, not in that order, but, you know, arrests and the prosecution, and then also community engagement to really make the Asian American community feel like government, the DA's office, the police, are there and are willing to take those steps in order to protect the community.
Thank you, Nancy. And I'll just add that, you know, in the last few months, on the other side of these terrible things happening, we have seen a lot of really great community organizing and support from organizations and people volunteering to walk people to buy groceries, people being trained to carry whistles and escort seniors to shopping and to the bus stops. We have seen folks organizing and lifting up their neighbors and calling people to make sure they're okay, and working with youth to make sure that they, you know, are watching for their elders. And I think one of the things that has been most uplifting is organizations that are Asian and organizations that are not Asian in their membership have stepped up to support, uplift, and see our Asian neighbors and offer love and support. And I think that all of those things we continue to support both financially, but also, you know, with our volunteer time and effort so that people feel like they're supported and loved.
Thank you. I have a final question for Lieutenant Harmston, and it comes out of the chat. And it's, if you interrupt a crime, like, or you see a crime happening, what should you do? Like, this chat mentions a catalytic converter steal, attempt to steal it. What should you do if you see that? And then also, if that happens, does the police tend to step up patrols in that area for people coming back? Or is there anything that can be done to try to make sure that they don't come back and try it a second time?
Sure, that's a great question. So I would say, first of all, to the person that I guess is Tom that has the question there, if he witnesses it from inside his house, somebody stealing a catalytic converter, obviously first thing is to call 911 and get a very good description of the suspect and also of the vehicle. Very important, because when officers arrive, that we know what the vehicle they're using to get away is. That way we can hopefully get there in time and detain them. I would recommend not confronting them themselves, because you don't know who you're dealing with. They might be armed. They might not. They might just run away, but you never know. And I wouldn't suggest a citizen take on somebody like that, because you just never know. Now, as far as a response, using our crime data, we map and keep track of these types of incidents, because they're so it becomes so commonplace now recently with the prices of precious metals going up. It's very lucrative for them to scrap these converters. So we do keep track of them. And then when we recognize that there's an area, we can dedicate resources, and that might be extra patrols, which is called passing calls to the area, or we might engage with our plainclothes team to monitor that neighborhood or that area to see if any of these people return. We can set up on them and catch them in the act and make the arrest.
Is it your experience that often they will come back to the same area, or do they, if they got scared away, do they generally go somewhere else?
Yeah, if they get scared away, generally they will try a different part of the city or neighborhood somewhere else, or even a different city. Now, if nobody calls the police or they're not seen, not necessarily come back to the same location, but they could come back and victimize the neighborhood again in a different location.
Well, thank you very much. This has been, I mean, we could talk about these issues for hours. And like I said, want to be respectful of everybody's time. But thank you very much. Mr. Wyatt from SF Safe, you had great suggestions. And Lieutenant, you've been wonderful. And Supervisor Melgar and Nancy Tong, you guys have all had a lot of interesting things to say, things to make everybody think about. And hopefully we won't have to do another meeting about crime, because it will become less of an issue as time goes on. But thank you all for your comments, and thank everybody for attending and listening, and for the people that sent in questions. And like I said, we didn't get to every question, but we got to as many as we could in the time. So thank you very much. And I think that I don't think you have anything else. So I thank you again, and we will see you sometime soon.
Thank you very much.
Great.
Thank you.
Good night, everyone.
Thank you, Sally. Appreciate it.
Thanks,
Dennis,
Frank.
And Sophia, you made it all happen. We greatly appreciate it.
Yes.
Thank you, Sally. Thank you, yes. Carla.
Thanks,
Frank.
Sophia.
Great meeting. A very good meeting.
Take care.
Carla, I'll send you guys, she vanished. Sally or Carla, I'll send you guys a copy of the finished video if you want that as a separate thing beyond the Facebook thing, if you wanted to post that on your website or something. We're going to, yeah, our first experiment, try to post these on YouTube.
Oh, okay.
Which gives a lot more access than Facebook.
Right.
So
that'd be great.
This will, yeah, be our first time, so no guarantees.
No, that'd be great. Yeah. Okay. Yes. Send anything you have.
Will do.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Good night, everyone.
Thank you guys so much for hosting.
Yeah, and, of course. Welcome. Anytime.
Yeah.
Dennis, I don't want to end the meeting until you stop the recording.
Oh, I'll.